Okay, the subject that was chosen Yoel, could you do me a favor? Could you ask them to switch off the air conditioning? Do you mind? Thanks. At the desk, I know how to do this. Thank you, appreciate it. The subject that was chosen was for today was exploring some of the principles of what we call machshava or shkafa. Those at the back, if you sit a little closer, you'll save my voice if you can. Let's try to take a look at this. I thought this would be more of a workshop for those who are involved in learning and teaching this area, or you have a special interest in it. So if I can, I'm happy to try to answer questions. But first, let me try to build a picture of some of the processes and thinking that are involved in this field. You know, Torah breaks down really into two divisions. I mean, you can obviously make many other distinctions, but there are two aspects of Torah learning generally that need to be approached in two different ways. One is the halachic area, and the other is the area that is the field of, very hard to find the right word, Jewish thought, or what we call machshava or hashkafa, which means the way of looking at things. But generally speaking, in the yeshiva world, that is the understanding is that there's a field of Jewish, maybe philosophy. I think the best definition is probably that which is not immediately halakhic, right? That probably is the best way to categorize this area. And it's a unique field of Torah study, and it has some unique issues and some unique problems. The problem here is that many people with a frum background, with a learning background, have got very good tools to approach the halachic area. If you find most young men who have been through yeshiva education, or not necessarily that young, you'll find that people with a solid yeshiva background usually have got a very good sense of how to approach an area in halacha. They know that there's certain principles and certain things you begin with. Basically, anybody who has any halachic exposure, any learning exposure, knows that. Is that for me? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you. It'll sound a lot better if I drink a coffee, right? Okay. Yesterday there was a fellow switched it off, so that's fine. Thank you. A person who has any background in Torah learning knows that when you work out a halachic issue, there's a certain way to do it. You know that basically it will always go back to a pasuk, the chumash. It will then find its expression in the Mishnah. The Gemara will elucidate and bring out the applications and the details of the Mishnah. And finally, you will probably take it into the world of the tshuvas, of the shailas and tshuvas that have been written throughout the ages, which form our set of precedents that identify the sources and give applications. It's a pretty clear pathway. And most people with yeshiva background would have the confidence that they could research a subject. If I said to you, any of the men sitting in this room, and probably the ladies, out of all I know, the ladies are more competent. If I said to you, could you research the halachas of, some problematic cosmetic on Pesach, you'd probably know more or less where to look. Even if you cheated by looking in an English, digest or a kitzer of some kind, you'd understand what's going on, you'd understand the thought process and how that was derived. Even if I said asked you something unusual, I said to you, what's the halacha of dangerous sport, right? Let's say you're a lady sitting in this room and you desperately like to get involved in American professional football. So, you'd like to play that, I'm sure all of you have had that longing. So if I say to you, is it allowed from a halachic point of view to do that which is dangerous on the one hand, on the other hand you're earning a living, you'd probably know more or less how to look that up, and you'd probably come up with a pretty competent answer. But if I asked you to work out a sugya in machshava, that means what is the formal approach and what is the formal derivation of a subject like the problem of free will, or the difference in definition between emunah and bitachon, or those sorts of areas, most people with a yeshiva background feel very uncomfortable. They've never been given the tools that you need in order to open up that area. And the truth is that there are tools. There are keys, there are codes. It's as well and clearly constructed an area as the halachic area. There's no question about it, and it's no less important. Because in this area live things like Emunah. Now, you can't tell me that Emunah is not an important area. It's arguably much more important than working out the details of a particular cosmetic on Pesach. Whether you're a man or a woman, you have to know that in that area live things like whether you ought to give your life under certain circumstances or not. Every Jew is obliged to know those things. You can't tell me because you're a lady, you know, you never really had thorough halachic training. That won't wash when it comes to an issue like Emunah, Bitachon, which not only are you required to know to the level of knowing when you have to give your life or not, but you are responsible for imbuing the next generation with those ultimately important things, which, again, are arguably more important than certain technical halachic details. And therefore, this is an area that has fallen into... I once met a certain Rosh Yeshiva. I was learning in that yeshiva once, and I said to him, why is it that whenever we come to a piece of Agadot in the Talmud, an area that deals with this, we go very rapidly, we skip it over, we don't spend any time in Chazor, and we get on to the next halachic piece. Why do we do that? And he said to me, because in halacha, at least we think we understand what's going on. That's what he said. But in these areas, we just don't know what's going on. That's what a very, very competent and one of the leading Rosh Yeshivas said to me in this particular generation. It has fallen into disuse or into... It's an area that seems much more vague, much more subjective. And the problem is that it has been inadequately taught, and that the specific problem is that people in Yeshiva world have never been given the keys that one needs to open up this area. There's a set of codes or keys or principles, and without those, one is going to flounder and not know how to look up or work out an area and a field in this most important of all areas. So let's try to lay down some of the principles that in fact are the keys or codes. I hope this discussion won't sound a little bit dry or academic as we identify. I'll try to give you examples. And then perhaps if we get some of the pattern clear, let's take a specific area and try to work through it and see how we would learn up or apply some of the principles at least that we can identify. Is that okay, that agenda? That's good? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay. Enthusiastic crowd, huh? Well, I presume that since you're here, you must be interested in the subject. So let's try to approach it. What are the keys that one needs to open up an area? You want to study something deep like Emunah, or problems of Bechira, or Yedian Bechira, or problems of where Jewish philosophy or this area of Machshava meets secular philosophical problems, whether it's the sense data problem in philosophy or problem of causality or whatever it is that philosophy has dealt with throughout the ages, and you want to know where does Judaism approach or how does it deal, what's the definitive Jewish approach to those difficult philosophical issues, then what are the keys that you need in order to begin studying this? How do you identify the sources and how do you work through the sources? I think you can make a list of certain principles that are fundamental tools that you need in order to open up this area. Let me try to mention a few of them. I'm not sure I'll be able to do it exhaustively, but I think we can probably put our finger on certainly the main ones or a number of the main keys that one needs in order to think through this area. The first probably, and each of these keys or ideas is itself a whole area in Machshava, right? Each of them needs thorough working out. Each of them has its own set of derivations and layers. But let's do the best we can. The first of these principles, I would say, is that in the area of Machshava, there's an absolute principle, an absolute axiom, that whenever you investigate one of these subjects, you always take it back to its source. In other words, the way Torah works is, right, let's try to discuss this as an amazing subject. The way Torah works is that any subject that's a Torah subject is always evolving from a nucleus, which contains the totality of the subject, and as it evolves, as it develops and moves out of that nucleus, you move to a second stage, which is completely loyal to the first stage, is derived entirely from the first stage, and is itself the nucleus of all that will follow thereafter. When you move to the third stage, you're looking at something that is developed and conditioned and created by the second stage, less potent, of course, because you're unfolding the subject, you're rolling it on into its more explicit, you're opening it up. but it will be completely loyal to the second stage, which is loyal to the first, and yet it will contain the rest of the process, because it's a nucleus with respect to what comes further, and so the subject will open itself up. When you get to the last stage, if you really can get to the last stage, you find an amazing thing. On the simplest level, you will get to a stage that has no more potential, because you've rolled out to the end, you've now got full and explicit demonstration of the subject, you've got to the tuff, having started from the Aleph, and miraculously and mysteriously you'll find, in a deep sense, you've come back to the point you began with. This is known as Sof Ma'aseh V'Machshava Tchila, and this is what the Kabbalists will describe. Now, we're going to have to relate to a few Kabbalistic concepts. Is that okay? I'm not going to get fired, am I? You're not going to report me to the... The Kabbalists would say this is why the world is founded on two serpents. You know that the world stands on two snakes? Do you know that? You thought it was turtles? What did you think it was? The world stands on... What? You know that by... Yeah? You know that by... I think it was the Greeks who taught, know that the world stands on... The world is created in the back of a turtle. Huh? Yeah. A giant turtle. And then one philosopher asked another one, and what does that turtle stand on? So he says, no, he stands on another one. So he said, no, but like, what does he stand on? So he said, no, the turtle's all the way down. Anyway, that's Greek. But in Jewish, in Svarim, they talk about these things, the world is based on two serpents. One is straight and one is circular. Okay, they have names, not necessarily how to go to the Kabbalistic jargon, but there are two serpents that are, one is male, one is female. The world stands, you know the word Nachash in Hebrew is the Gematria Mashiach. Think about that. Amazing. The problems of the world begin with the Nachash and they end with... Anyway, be that as it may. The word Nachash also means to... Nichush means to... It means to derive on a deeper plane by certain divination methods. Amazing thing. Alright, we'll have to study this. But the world is based on two serpents. One is straight and the other one is circular that has his tail in his mouth. Of course, Yiddish Torah is always based on unity. These two serpents must be one, which means that everything has a process that goes from head to tail, and yet describes a circle that brings you back to where you began. This needs to be thought through. But the point is that a process is always starting with a multipotent, completely potent source, and then it's unfolding itself in stages. If you investigate any Torah subject, you know, in the halachic realm, it's not that different. What did we say? Any halachic area, any halacha, will go back to a discussion in the Gemara. Any discussion in the Gemara always go back, the Gaon says, to the particular Mishnah that Gemara is on, even in the area of Machshava. The Mishnah will always go back to a derivation in Chumash, whether it's a pasuk or a hint between the lines or a drosha, or even a halacha l'moshe m'Sinai, will always come back to a Torah. The process here is a parallel type of process. Let's, for a moment, examine what this means. First of all, what do we mean practically? And then let's take a moment just to examine what we mean on a deeper level. Practically, we mean that when you investigate a subject, if I say to you, work out the subject of nisayon, right? Or deals in Torah. Or free will. Or marriage, for example. Or the deep approach to any life issue from a Torah perspective, then your training should be that you always follow it down to its ultimate root. You don't pick up the process at some arbitrary point and think you've understood it. Let me give you an analogy. In medicine, if you wish to understand the body, no student of anatomy would ever consider that he's done his job fully, no matter how much detail he's understood any feature of the body, and this has gone back to the way that looks in the embryo. For example, without getting into the detail, if you wish to understand the human heart, the anatomy of the human heart, if you study the heart as an object, as an organ, its shape is arbitrary. That means why it's shaped the way it does and why the vessels that come out of it arch around the way they do, that's just the way it is. But if you watch the heart develop in a fetus, it's a most amazing explanation of the way the heart looks in an adult. Because in a fetus, the heart is an absolutely simple structure, it's just a simple straight tube. And it unfolds itself and refolds itself in a particular fashion that by the time the heart is developed in the adult, you have a full explanation of why it looks that way. But no competent embryologist would think that he's done his work thoroughly unless he went back to the genetics. You see, you always must go back to a prior stage, yeah? That explains today that the pervasive theme in medicine is to find genetic causes for almost everything. Virtually a week doesn't go by without a study coming out defining the so-called genetic cause of a particular illness, or at least it. The reason is that you always go back to the causative level in order to understand. In Torah, whenever you identify a Torah subject, you're always looking for the level where this subject is explained by a prior level. Let me give you an example of this. The God of Vilna says that, I think we mentioned this before, the God says that the first time a thing appears in Chumash is always the definition of its essence. And to do your job thoroughly when you investigate a Torah subject, you should always make sure you've gone back to the first time it appears in Chumash, and more specifically, the time it appears in the 6 days of creation. Because in the Shesh Yishmei Bereshis, in the 6 or 7 days of creation, since the whole world is being created then, everything that occurs in the world later must have a root there. It's not possible that it would appear later, okay? It can be anything. Even seeming aberrations like Nisim, the Gemara says, are derived from a statement in the 6 days of creation, even though they seem to break the order. For example, the Medrash says that Hashem made a Tnai condition with all of Ma'aseh Bereishis, that when they need to change their nature, they will change, but they can only change later because a Tnai was made, right, in Ma'aseh Bereishis. You know that, just tell you a beautiful anecdote about this, is the Chaim Volozhin, when he used to go and speak to the Gaon. You know, the Gaon of Vilna was his Rebbe, and the students saw the Gaon very seldom. Just a few hours a year. He had a most amazing effect on his students, even though he was closeted away and learning most of the time and didn't have that much time with him. On one occasion, Reb Chaim actually heard this from somebody who's a descendant of the family. Reb Chaim once went in to see the Gaon, and he took his little son, Reb Itzler, who was about 6 or 7 years old at the time, for the privilege of that particular meeting. And Reb Chaim went in to ask the Gaon his various questions, and his son was with him. One of the questions that Reb Chaim asked the Gaon was this. On one particular occasion, he said to him that, and this is just gives such a beautiful insight into this process. He said like this: the Pasuk says that after the splitting of the sea, right? Pesach, we're moving towards that. After the splitting of the sea, the Pasuk says, "V'chazach hayom le'esonoi." The ocean returned to its strength. Instead of being vertical, it returned to its former natural strength. The drasha on that in Chazal is letznai harishon. Esanai means its strength, but a derivation on those words can also be it returned to its former condition, not condition in the condition meaning conditional, right? Tznai. And the Medrash says that Hashem had in fact made a condition with the ocean that it would one day split, and this condition had now been fulfilled, and therefore it returned to its former state. Yet, based on this particular condition. And that's well known, and that's what it says. But here's what Reb Chaim asked the Gaon of Vilna. He said to him, if it returned to its former state, and there was a condition made that once it would split, only temporarily, where do we find earlier in Chumash that condition mentioned? Where do you see in Chumash? Again, Chazal tell us that the sea split only because Hashem made a condition with the ocean. And in fact, that's what happened. And we accept that. But he didn't accept that. He said to the Gaon, if it's true that this was a condition made, you should be able to find it in Chumash. Why was he asking this question? Because he knew, and of course he knew it from the Gaon. Because the Gaon was the one who taught that every time a principle occurs, any issue that arises in Chumash, there's always a time in Chumash yet that the first time it appears that defines it, and specifically within the 6 days of creation. So following his Rebbe's teachings, he said to his Rebbe, where do you see in Chumash any place, any mention, of a condition that, fine, Chazal say it and it's in a Medrash, but show me the verse in the Torah, that stipulates that one day the sea will split. Where do you find it? I challenge you, find any pasuk in Chumash that shows me, written before Kriyas Yom Suf, that the sea will split later on a condition. Where do you find that? So that's what he asked the Gaon. Do you understand the thinking behind the question? Okay. Before the Gaon could answer, the child grabbed his father's sleeve and he said, Tati, Tati, why don't you ask me? Don't have to ask the study that question. Why don't you ask me? So Reb Chaim tried to, put him in his pocket. I don't know what he tried to do. But the Gaon said, no. And he picked him up and he put him on a chair and he said, Zog. So a little child stood up on the chair and he said, the Pasuk says in Ma'aseh Bereishis, Yikavu ha-mayim mitachas la-shamayim al-mokom echod, v'seiroi ha-yabosha. That's what the child said. The verse says, let all the waters under the heavens be gathered unto one place, and let the dry land be revealed. That's a pasuk that tells us that the whole world was covered in the ocean, and Hashem split gathered together all the, yikavu means loshon mikveh, gathered together all the waters so that the dry land is revealed. Said the 7-year-old child, if it says, yikavu amayim mitachas la-shamayim al-makom echad, if it says that all the waters that were gathered into one place, of course the dry land is revealed. Why does it then go on to say, and let the dry land be revealed? That's referring to Kriyas Yamsuf, where the waters will again be revealed, the dry land again, a second time. The God kissed him on his head, and he said, that's the... No? So you see, you only have to be 7 years old to learn... that's what he said. Of course, there's a depth here. I'm not sure when he was 7 years old he realized. But you think through this. It isn't only that the Torah says it the first time. When the Torah says it the first time, it's setting up the reality for the second time. Think about it for a moment. When Hashem gathered all the waters together and revealed the dry land, what was he doing? He was creating a place for human beings to live. Right? He was making what's called the Tegel, the dry land, the continental masses, on which humankind would live. When he split the sea a second time, he was recreating dry land for the Jewish people to live on. You see, what's going on here is that this is no accident. It's no accident that this event is presaged in Chumash by the waters being gathered and dry land being revealed. Who lives there? Humankind. There's a second creation in the world for the people who live on a higher plane. And again, it's no accident that that's again done by waters being split and the new dry land being revealed. But the dry land that's revealed for us, Heichin Tevel Adoso, it says. Heichin Tevel Adoso, the Pasuk says in Tehillim. Hashem prepared dry land for his people. Yeah, not for mankind, for his people. And our dry land is a different kind of dry land. Our dry land is a miraculous dry land where the ocean has been split, and we're walking on dry land, and says the Sfas Emes, as I pointed out before, underwater. Because our dry land is a miraculous duality of two. And therefore you see that there are two levels of creation. The first level of creation is the dry land that's humankind, are inhabiting, and the second is, and therefore it's not just accidental or incidental that the first time it's mentioned, and therefore it follows through, that this is, of course, you have two levels of, because the Jewish people look on a higher plane. You know that the Kabbalistic teaching is, of course, that each plane has one higher, and each plane, yes, that's what he says, human beings on one plane, actually the lowest is the inanimate, above that you have the demon, the domain above that you have the tzemach, the plant kingdom, above that you have the chai, animal, above that you have the human, the daber, above that you have the Jewish people. And Chaim always used to say, Chaim Shulevitz used to say, above the human people, above above a human, you have a yeshiva bocha, and above that you have a mirror yeshiva bocha. Right? Anyway, so what have we learned? We've learned that there's always a time that you can go back to, specifically in Maaseh Bereishis, that represents the source of this thing, and from there the whole picture will unfold. And nothing will occur in this concept later that isn't coded for in that particular thing. Just like there's nothing in the body that will not emanate from the genes as they have been originally laid down. I think I mentioned to you the example that God himself gives, is that the Gemara in Brachos says, Harei etes b'chalam, when you see a tet, yeah, the letter tes in a dream, yitzap l'toiv. Because the word Toiv begins with a test, says the Gaon. Why should you expect something good to happen? There are lots of bad things that start with a test. Because the first time a test appears in Chumash is Ki Toiv. And therefore, but you see what he's teaching you is that when you find the first time it appears, you're finding it's swimming into focus in its creation. That will always be its essence. And therefore, that's the code. Let's try and just look a little bit deeper into this. You see what's happening here really is that in the moment of conception, the whole thing is created, and it unfolds from there. It follows that the first moment is by far the most potent and the most significant. If you want an analogy, I would say this. If you take a human body and you make a scratch, a small injury, well, it's a small injury. But if you take a fetus going through its stages of development and you make the same injury, that would have much more far-reaching consequences. But if you take the genes as they're beginning to be formed, you could have the most microscopic change, imperceptibly small change, that could have far greater consequences later. Because when you're talking about, actually the Chazal say in Rashi brings, that the world really was not created in 6 days. The whole world was really created only in the first instant. In the first instant of Yesh Me'ayin, the whole thing was there. Only, what happened then was 6 days of revelation of the 6 stages. And then there were 6,000 years later, which revealed nothing other than what was built in the 6 days. But we're always compressing it back into a previous layer and compressing it back into that. There are many applications of this principle. One simple one would be that Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah being the beginning of the year of the human being. Pesach is the beginning of the year of the Jewish people. Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of the year of the human, as an individual, right? Rosh Hashanah, the whole world is judged. You don't have to be Jewish for that. And Rosh Hashanah, called by Olam. All humans are judged on Rosh Hashanah. The whole world is judged. We're talking about the formation of the individual, right? We talk about the formation of Adam Rishon then. the idea of Rosh Hashanah, just to give you a practical example, the day on Rosh Hashanah is so significant, Mekubalim, for example, would never sleep, right, on the first day of Rosh, at least not until the middle of the day. Why? Because the way you look on that day is coding for what you'll look like the rest of the year. Why? Because in the moment of conception, the moment of birth, the way you look then, you'll never be able to change later. Later, what you'll be able to change is only through very brutal surgery and gross manipulations you'll be able to change. But when you're working in the genes, when you're working in the moment of formation, when you're working in the where it's all compressed and it's all happening, the rest is only going to be a gilui, a revelation, a description, an explication of what happened in the first moment. And that's why first moments are so incredibly important. You have the same example in chinuch, for example, when a child is very young. Right? And in the moment of formation of the child, the first experiences of the child, that's why we make such a fuss about a child's first exposure to aleph bais, right? In many traditions, the child is carried to the Rebbe, and then he's unwrapped, as it were, and the first thing he sees is aleph bais with honey or candy, right? We're doing this because it's not just a sweet tradition, it's because the beginning will always... If that child gets that message effectively when he's 6 and 7 years old, 3 years old when he sees that, when he's 73 years old, he'll still taste the honey. It'll be at a deeper level and a deeper level and deeper, but you're building here a course of energy. I remember once a couple took their 6-month-old baby to see a very charismatic Hasidic Rebbe, happened to be visiting where they were, and this was a very obviously a very unusual child. The fact that she happened to be my first daughter was completely irrelevant. We came into this rabbi and we said his first child, you know, very idealistic. So we said, you know, we'd like a bracha that this child should be incredibly unusual, you know, great in every way. And you know, he looked at us and he said, but it's much too late for that. Much too late. She's 6 months older. It's much too late. So that sort of broke. She turned out to be incredible and great, you know. Anyway, but the point is, he gave her bracha. She should be wholesome. But what he was teaching, what he was saying was, right, you can't go back early enough in terms of the powers of formation. And therefore, this is an absolutely pervasive theme that any place you look, you've not done your job properly. You look in the Gemara, you find, let's say, you want to work out the sugya of Bechira or Yedin Bechira, and you find a place where it's discussed. Unless you've gone back to the first time it's discussed, to the definitive mission that talks about it, the definitive event in Tanakh that talks about it, the definitive event in Chumash that talks about that event in Tanakh, etc., etc., etc. You want to study the subject of Nisoyon, human ordeals. The Gemara talks about it as a classic discussion, we went through it before, of David HaMelech and Bathsheba. That's the classic definition of the Sugya of Nisoyon. But you go back to Adam HaRishon, because that's where all Nisoyon is, right? And you'll find the absolute essence of all human ordeal in the experience of Adam HaRishon when he was given his original challenge, you'll find it all there. Strictly speaking, if you have a knowledge of the deeper sources, you'd have to go back before my subversions. Because the idea of the Kabbalistic wisdom, right, is to teach the roots of these things before they appear in the world. Yeah? For example, without going into... And if you say I talked about this, I'll deny it. It is in the Kabbalistic writings a thing called the breaking of the vessels. Shri Asakeli, breaking of the vessel. When did it happen? On Tisha B'Av, in the year before time was formed. Get that? Neat thought. But what they are doing is they're going back beyond Maaseh Bereishis into the spiritual roots in the higher world, which are then explained, and we'll try perhaps to talk a bit more about this, which are explained by the physical phenomena as they begin to manifest. That's one theme that is a priceless tool to use in opening up these subjects. And if you haven't taken it back and cannot see it all the way through its stages, then you do not have a full, and let's call it professional, grasp of that particular subject. Let's look at one or two other themes and see if we can identify them. Another theme is that all of these areas in Torah thinking always go back to the words that are used in Lashon Kodesh. The Hebrew language, the language of Torah, is the fundamental tool that explains and develops all its concepts. This is such a fundamental thing to grasp. In other languages, all concepts are denoted by words only by convention. When I say a word that indicates a table or a chair or something else, the only reason you respond correctly is because you've been taught knowing that, yeah, we have a convention that that word means that thing. In Lashon Kodesh, it's not like that. In Hebrew, the word actually means the thing. It actually constructs the thing. The root of this, of course, is the fact that the Torah is the reason, is the cause of all things. We discussed this also a few days ago, Torah being the root cause of reality. a muscle I could use, perhaps in the terms of the genetics we discussed already today, the genes are the reason. The genes don't describe the body, they cause it to be that way. Torah doesn't describe the world, it causes it to be that way. Meaning that when you find the word that the Torah uses for a particular thing, you are experiencing the mechanism that builds that thing in the world. It's not a description. If you want that more useful analogy, easier to grasp maybe, when light is shone through a film and the film projects itself on a screen, then every detail on the screen, you'll find the root of it on the film. The Torah is like the film, and the world's like the screen. So any object or experience or phenomenon in the world that you want to understand, strictly speaking, you need do no more than find the word the Torah uses for that thing. Once you've found the word for that thing, you will know everything about the experience if you know how to analyze the word correctly in terms of the numerology of its letters, the shapes of the letters, the combinations. Each letter in Hebrew adds a root energy, a root force. Take an aleph. Take an aleph. What should aleph be? What should aleph be? Let's go back to our first principle. Stay with me. We said that beginnings always contain totality, and then they unfold. Therefore, an aleph, which is beginning of the whole process, should contain totality, everything. But what is an aleph? Aleph teaches you the concept of a spiritual reality coming down and manifesting in the world at its point of origin, drawing down from the higher world that is not manifest, and putting into the world that is manifest. What, after all, is an aleph? It's two yuds and a vav. An aleph is two yuds and a vav. Yud is always the letter indicating the 10 spheres, right? The 10 higher emanations, Kabbalistic forces, whatever it is, that are the units of building the world, coming down from the higher world, reflected by what they are in this world, joined together, cemented together by the vav. Vav always means connection in Hebrew, right? Vav means and. Vav, the word vav means a hook, right? The Kabbalists say vav is the letter of connection that goes straight up and down. So what is an aleph? Aleph is a symbol of connection of higher and lower worlds being brought into focus, and of course it adds up to 26, right? Two yuds and a vav is 26, which is Hashem's name, which is the point of origin of connection of all that is above. I mean, it goes up. The word aleph, you know, in Hebrew, unlike all other languages, letters are also words. See, this is an endless subject. Letters in Lashon Kodesh, you know, in these gateway seminars that they run, one of the most powerful themes they give over to people is simply the Hebrew language. You don't need more than an understanding of the Hebrew language to make you frum. There's nothing more powerful in bringing people in to understand that Hebrew language is like a chemical, like the chemical elements of the chemical table, right? When you combine them, you get incredible combinations. If you know your chemistry, you know that chemistry is an amazing thing. If you know that the entire world, in all its complexity with which you're familiar, is based on a handful of elements. Do you know there are only about 150 known elements, and most of them are only experienced experimentally. The whole world that you're familiar with, basically made of carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, a handful of objects, of chemicals, makes the incredible complexity in the world. Because they're so craftily combined. Sodium, for example. Sodium is an explosive metal. You know that? When sodium is exposed to air, it explodes. Chlorine is a poisonous green gas. You put the two together, you get salt. Isn't that amazing? The nature of those elements is they're so cunningly constructed that when you put them together, and salt is a large part of what your body comprises, and it never explodes spontaneously or turns into a poisonous green gas. That's stupid. The letters of the alphabet are like that. By combining letters, you get combinations of such beautiful and amazing complexity, all explained by the elements that are being constructed, right? Not only that, but the letters themselves are words. The aleph itself is a word. Aleph means to teach, to elevate. La aleph, right? Means to teach or elevate spiritually. By the way, it could be that English, you know, other languages are fragments of Hebrew. At the Tower of Babel, all languages fragmented out from Lashon Kodesh, from Hebrew. It's conceivable that aleph and eleph is the root of the English word elevate, right? Maybe even elephant. Possibly, yeah, it's a debatable subject, but it's possible. But be that as it may, aloof, the English word aloof, to be above, right? The aleph means that. Aleph is 1,000, the highest number, the no high number in Torah. Rivavah is not a number, it means a lot, right? Aleph is the highest number. Aluf is the highest rank in Hebrew. You see? And of course, Aleph is amazing. It's the highest number, and it's back to the Aleph. You know that if you add up all the letters in the Aleph base, you get 999. You know that? Aleph plus base plus gimel plus chaf plus cetera comes to 999. What's the gematria, by the way, of 999? What word is 999? Petach Tikva. Petach Tikva, 999, deep Kabbalistic idea. And then you get the Aleph. You get Aleph, which is back to Aleph. This is why King Solomon married 1,000 women. Huh? Because each one was, doesn't sound good to you? No? Each one, they think how much free time you get, how much time you get. So the Aleph is, and that's why in Lashon Kodesh, Aleph, Aluf, right? These are all the, so the Aleph really says it all. It contains the root that will work itself out into, and that's of course why it's one, it's unity, it's all those elements being unified. Aleph is the only silent letter because it's not yet fully in the world. That's the Neshama letter. From then on, all the letters have a sound. Aleph is not yet expressed, it's only the Chibur, it's only coming down. Any word in Lashon Kodesh that begins with an Aleph will always have this element. Ish, Isha, Eish, Avir. Yeah, any word will have this, especially as its first letter, will have this ethereal letter of connection always being its source, right? And so forth and so on. I think I explained before, Afer as opposed to Afar, right? You know, when Aleph becomes Ayin, then it comes down into the world, right? Afer is Ash, which is only elements. Afar is now when the elements have combined in a way that can actually be a rich earth for some development. If you want a very instructive exercise, make a list of all the Hebrew words where you transpose the Aleph for an Ayin. And you'll see you get a spiritual thing coming down into the physical. Aleph Vav Resh is light. Ayin Vav Resh, right, means skin, which means, and it spells Iver, blind. You cannot see. Man was originally created with a skin of light. After the sin, he became created with a skin of skin, which you cannot see through anymore, right? You see, it's a very instructive exercise to do. But the point is that, by the way, just one more dimension here. What is Gematria? What is Gematria? People think Gematria is playing games with numbers, you know. Yeah. You know what Gematria is? Gematria is the numerical equivalent of the verbal expression. You see, you take a word in Hebrew, and you read the word. The word then gives you a meaning. You transpose it into its numbers, and you have the mathematical equivalent of what the word's meaning is. Do you know what that is? That's like, imagine an engineer describes to you a bridge that he wants to build, and he writes a poetic description of the bridge. You take his description, you translate all the letters into numbers, and you get the mathematical formulae, engineering formula that stipulate the bridge. Isn't that incredible? Isn't that amazing? In English, the only way you can do that is, you write a verbal description of the bridge, and then you transpose into mathematics. You use different symbols, Arabic symbols, yeah, which are the numbers, in order to define the science or the mathematics. In Torah, the same system does both. I mean, that's enough to make you from, you know, like overnight. I mean, you can take a description of a thing, a word, transpose it into its numbers, and it says the same thing in scientific notation. Do you see what's going on? That's the concept. It gives you the technical specification, whereas the verbal expression gives you the verbal meaning, right? And the two are both located in the same text. There's much more to say here, obviously, but the basic concept is any Inyan in Ashkafa, anything in Machshava, any area that's deep in Torah is always located in the words themselves. You need no more than a study of the word, right? The example we used before, the word Nisayon, we discussed that, is based on Nes, means there's a miraculous element to every test. Whichever word you're taking, whichever area. By the way, there are many wonderful spin-offs. One of the spin-offs that Rav Dessler used to be fond of expressing, what happens when you examine something in the world, and you do this loyally, you go back to the Torah to find the word, and you find there's no word. Here's your film, right? The film is put on the screen. You see something on the film. You do what exercise we've said today. Go back to the Torah, identify the word, and you'll know the genetics of the thing. What happens when you experience something, go back to the Torah and find there's no word? This thing's an illusion. Somebody has painted this up here in the human, the realm of human awareness, but it's not being, Hashem never built that thing. Examples. Rav Dessler's favorite, one of his favorite examples was, in Hebrew you cannot say have. You can't say I have. You can't say that in Hebrew. The concept he used to explain was, we tend to judge value by possession. What I'm worth is what I have. Even call it what I'm worth, what I have. Torah wants to get you away from that. So it teaches you not to think about yourself in terms of value, in terms of what you have, but rather what you are. And therefore, in English, you can say, I have. In Hebrew, you can only say, yesh li, which means it exists in its own right, and it relates to me. You can't say, I have. Amazing thing. You can't say nature in Hebrew. The word teva is a word of rabbinic origin. The word in Torah means to drown. Teva means to drown, or it means an embossed image. That matbea is a coin in relief. Why did Chazal coin the word teva for that? Again, why is there no word for teva? Because our principle is enred milvodei. There's nothing besides Hashem. It looks to you like there's a self-maintaining, self-generating cause and effect sequence that we call nature. It looks that way. It looks that way. But if Hashem had put a word into the Torah called teva, then there would be an independent system of things creating themselves. And that's not true. So we perceive it that way, so we give a name to our perception. We write it up on our screen for shorthand because it's useful. But if you go back to the root in the Torah, you won't find anything. Why did Chazal choose that word? Because nature is exactly that. If you take it at face value and think it's real, you drown in it. What does drown mean? Become part of the medium. You'll sink into becoming a natural creature. But if you see that nature is not like that, it's a coin, it's an image being stamped out by something that's no longer here, you'll perceive the root. You'll go back and see. You'll meditate on a tree and you'll realize there's a root of this that looks like that, and you'll project yourself back. So nature gives you that option. So Chazal coined a word that show you the danger and the solution. Isn't that amazing? That's right. There's no word for doubt in Hebrew. Know that? Safek and Vadai are words of rabbinic origin. You look through Chumash, the Tanakh, you will not find a word for doubt or a word for certainty. Why? Hashem never created anything doubtfully. Show me something that exists doubtfully. No such thing. Doubt is a problem of our perception. We are confused about reality, so we name that confusion. But the Torah never create anything doubtfully. Do you know what the Kabbalists call the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Eitz Hadas Tevera. Why? You think about it for a moment. Why is it called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? It should be called the tree of the knowledge of evil. It was a tree that was very problematic. Why is it called good and evil? The concept is that that's the tree that gets you confused. When you eat from the fruit of that tree, evil doesn't enter the world. The mixture of good and... Das means mixture always. Das means chibur, right? Connection. Das tovara means that good and evil become so meshed with each other that you can't tell them apart anymore. When man eats from the fruit of that tree, he doesn't become evil, he becomes confused. What's the result of eating from the fruit? He hides under the trees. Hides from whom? From one who sees through the trees? Adam hadn't forgotten that. He spoke to Hashem face to face. 2 minutes later, he's hiding from Hashem who sees through the trees. Talk about confused. And what's the result, by the way? What's the result? Hashem arrives in the garden. Adam's hiding under the trees like, maybe Hashem doesn't see me. And Hashem arrives in the garden and says, where are you? That's how you want to play the game? Do you see what's happening? Man is setting up a relationship of complete confusion where he thinks Hashem doesn't see him and he causes Hashem to play the same game. So then, could you imagine he's hiding under the trees. What was he feeling at that time? He must have been in a turmoil of shame, and his deepest wish must have been, Hashem, just schlep me out of here and fix me up. And Hashem arrives and says, where are you? I don't see you. So he drags himself out and Hashem says, did you eat? Hamin, I don't know. Hamin ha'etz? And of course Chazal say, Hamin is Haman. That's where Amalek is born. Amalek, gematria, Safek. You see what's happening here? Because Amalek is the gap. Hashem doesn't see. It's all accident. It's all... See what's unfolding here. All from the words themselves. In Kabbalah, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is called Ilana Desfeka. And that's where all Nisayon begins. He's being confused. He's not knowing what he really wants from you. It all goes back to there, right? Etc. Etc. So these are words that don't exist. And of course, if you work in Kiruv, then you want to take that subject further. You can demonstrate those are kosher words. Yes? Sofek, etc. Kosher words that we use in Hebrew that are not derived from Tanakh. But if you live in a culture where you want to demonstrate to people that the culture we live in is completely divorced from a Torah culture, you can show them that the central concepts that make the West, in the culture and the media, that make the Western mind move, none of those words can be expressed in Hebrew at all. In Hebrew, you cannot say entertainment, you can't say fun, you can't say vacation, you can't say chivalry, you can't say etiquette, you can't say adventure, you can't say romance. There are no words for those things. You know, there's a machlokes. The Rambam says the reason we call it Lashon Kodesh, why is it called a holy language? A language of holiness. The Rambam says because in Hebrew there's no vulgarity. The Rambam says the reason it's a holy language is you cannot be vulgar in Hebrew. If you want to speak about humiliating aspects of nakedness or physiological functions that in other cultures are taken for curses and swearing, In Hebrew, you can't do that. The only way you can express those things in Torah is in very refined euphemisms, which refer in a very refined way to those things. Are you with me? In modern Hebrew, if you wish to curse in a vulgar fashion, you have to speak Arabic. No, I'm not kidding. That's how it is. You can't do that. You cannot curse. There are no vulgarities. There are no profanities, and you can't do that. Imagine trying to curse somebody in a very coarse in Hebrew. It comes out in a very refined, amazing thing. But the deeper concept, this is Rambam saying, but the parallel here is it's called Lashon Kodesh because the words actually mean and create the things. That's why it's called Lashon Kodesh, right? It's a holy language because it's a language of creation. Think about it for a moment. How was the world created? It was spoken into existence. When it says Vayomer Elokim, it doesn't mean he gave an instruction and then some underling scurried around doing it. That's a superficial. It means that he said the word and his word concretized, condensed, crystallized into the object. The word is the thing. Yeah, Vayomer Elokim means he said the word into existence. That's why in Hebrew, in the film of Torah, the word is davar, meaning a word. And in the world of reality, davar means an object. The same word in Hebrew means a thing and a word. There's no other language like that. Does anyone in this room speak any language besides English?
Yeah.
In any language that you speak, is the word for a word and the word for a thing the same word? No. Because a word is an utterance and a thing is a thing. But Lashon Kodesh, they're the same thing. Because the word is the thing. You know, the corollary, of course, everything in the world should be speaking to you. Everything in the world should be speaking. The world's a dialogue. You know, let's take an application. See how far this goes. Let's take an application. Do you know why we make brachas? Why do you make a blessing? Do you know blessings were instituted by Sheikh Nesses Hagdela? Take a moment to understand this. Blessings, brachas, were made by the men of the Great Assembly. Before that, Jews did not make blessings. Before the men of the Great Assembly, Jews did not make blessings. There were only two brachas that people made. Because of Torah, which is the Raisa, and because of Muslim, which is the Raisa. But other than that, people didn't make blessings. And today, there's nothing in Jewish life that doesn't have a blessing. Nothing. Open your eyes in the morning, go to sleep at night. Get born, die. Use the bathroom. Try telling a Buddhist or a Hindu that we go into spiritual raptures about using the bathroom. Try explain that religious concept. A Jew uses the bathroom, and you come out and you start, you know what mafli la'asos means? Mafli la'asos. You know what pele means? What is pele?
Marrakesh.
Aleph. But it's the letters of Aleph. What did we say Aleph is? Connection between higher and lower worlds. That's amazing that in this body that contains excrement is a divine soul. That's Pele, that's Aleph. So you say, yeah? But the point is that there's nothing in our life that doesn't involve a bracha. So what happened? Before Sheikh Nesses Hagdola, there was no blessings. After Sheikh Nesses Hagdola, you have to make 100 brachas. Actually, the derivation of that goes back before in a certain sense, but they made up brachas. Nothing you touch, eat, relate to doesn't involve a bracha. Why? Here's the concept. You know what a bracha means? Baruch atah Hashem does not mean Hashem, you are blessed. I'm giving you a bracha. Nefesh HaChaim says Baruch means Hashem, you are the source of this thing that is a blessing, that is a tesefes ribui in the world. Baruch means I'm identifying the source of bracha. He says it goes further. When you identify the source, you bring down more from that source. Okay, that's a further level. But the word Baruch means that the source, when you say, we take an apple and you say, Baruch Atah Hashem, Kedem Melech Olam, you say, Vayireh Pri Eitz, what you are saying is, Hashem, I'm acknowledging that you are the source of this apple. That's what you say. Why were there no brachas before Sheikh Nesses Hagdola? Because Sheikh Nesses Hagdola came at the cusp of history when Nevuah ended, prophecy ended. You know what prophecy means? Prophecy doesn't mean simply there are individuals who know the future. That's a childish concept. That in the phone book under Nun, yes, you can find someone who can tell you tomorrow's weather. You know, that's childish. Prophecy means that the whole world is incandescent with spiritual wisdom. The world is luminescent. That's what it means. There are individuals who get to, but the whole world has to be glowing with its gilu. It's a different world. The world of Nebuah is a different world. It's megalic for Shemayim. When Nebuah is around, every object speaks its word. What is Nebuah? Lashon Kodesh. Nebuah is Lashon Kodesh. The Rambam says when the prophet spoke, you experienced what he said. You didn't hear him. You experienced what he said. It's a language that demonstrates that when the Nevuah is around, any object in the world as a davar object is also a davar word. It speaks its message. It says, I am a product of Hashem. So when you take an apple, you see the problem is today when you take an apple, today an apple Nebuch looks like an apple. But when Nebuch was around, an apple looked like a creation of Hashem. So you didn't need to make a bracha. You didn't need. You see, when Nebuch was around, an apple was an object and a word. So you took this apple, and the apple spoke to you of its own source. After the world went dark, and on Sheikh Nesses Agdola came on the scene, there's no more Nebuch. Now an apple looks like an accidental evolutionary biological object. So now you've got to say, Hashem, you are the source of this apple, and you've got to teach yourself to hear the word again, because you don't hear it anymore. Do you see what's happening? So, but the basic idea is every object in the world is a word, davar, davar. And therefore, you've not studied the subject in Mashallah thoroughly unless you've gone back to the word the Torah uses for that thing. In the culture we live in, as I pointed out, there are many things that there are no words for. Adventure, etiquette, romance, etc. Those are concepts that make the West move. A large part of what people are involved in is romantic and in one sense or another, right? And in Hebrew you can't say it. Why? Because there's no essence to those things. What is adventure? Did we discuss this?
No.
We never discussed this? What is adventure? It's the idea of going and doing something thrilling and dangerous for the sake of the fact that it's thrilling and dangerous. What sort of person ties a rubber rope to his ankle and sees if he can leap off some, you know, how close he can come to becoming part of the scenery, you know? But the Hebrew word we have for that is meshugah, right?
No.
You see, why there is some truth in that concept. There is a particular thrill and a particular sense of being alive. But in essence, people of spiritual greatness don't go leaping off cliffs with rubber ropes attached to their ankles to have a sense of being alive. Romance. We have a word for love. But romance is an artificial beginning of a relationship that hasn't involved any genuine giving yet. Etiquette, chivalry, what is etiquette? What is etiquette? I'm living in England now. You Americans have
a way to go.
I would say less of a dose of the concept of etiquette. But in Britain, you know, like it's worth more than life itself. Etiquette, you know, if you don't put the knife and fork on the right side and say, I have the experience of being an officer in the South African Army. South African Army is modeled on the British Army. When I became an officer, being a medical officer, so you have rank. In order to get your rank, you have to study a thick book called Officer and Gentleman. You have that, David? Officer and Gentleman. It's a book of officers' rules. Okay? And most of the book involves alcohol. In other words, you go to the officer's dinner, then you're going to get five different, there's a sherry glass, a port glass, a wine glass, a champagne, like, and it has to be in the right order. You get it mixed up, they shoot you. You know, you're talking about, like, this is officer and gentleman. It's like, there are rules, right? And if you get the rules wrong, why? Because there's a, you see, the concept of etiquette is a concept of rules for their own sake. Why does it matter where your knife and fork? It's the rules, there's in Torah, he said, I remember the experience once when I was first student and I had a wonderful Rebbe and I went to him and said, what a real special individual. And I said to him, no, I've been brought up in the Western mode with certain gentlemanly things. You're dating a young lady and suddenly you open the door for her, she goes first. Does it make sense from a Jewish point of view? What's the Torah attitude to those things? How should I conduct myself? So he looked at me like I crawled out of the woodwork and he said, in Torah, etiquette is what makes sense. Use seichel, okay? If it's a boiling hot day, then get in the car first, open all the windows, and then let her in. If it's raining, open the door and let her in first. You see, in the British etiquette system, she goes first no matter what. It's a dangerous dark alley. Open the door. But the concept is the rules for the sake of the rules, you see? And that's what etiquette is. And if you examine Western culture, you'll find so many of these things. They have a thing called fair play. Again, this is a very British thing. Fair play, the rules. You don't hit a man when he's down. Hunter and hunted have to be on equal terms. Right? There's all this chivalrous, yeah? In the old, not so long ago, it used to be played out in duels. And you insulted a person's regiment or his woman, you know, then like you throw his glove down and you go and shoot each other to death. I mean, you're talking about, you know, where the format, the structure is so important, it's worth more than life itself, right? etiquette. Victor Miller used to be fond of telling the story of, just to show the contrast between our sense of, am I keeping you too long?
No.
The sense of, the sense of, our sense of etiquette, you know, and how the rules are applied. Beautifully, he tells the story of two Hasidic dynasties whose children married. So in Russia, 150, 200 years ago, and children got married. It was an incredible wedding with hundreds of thousands of Hasidim that all came to be present. and 7 days of tremendous festivities. One of the things the Hasidim did, the young men, as part of the mitzvah of Simchas Chasam v'Nesamech Chasam v'Kala, they got dressed in Russian military uniforms, with every detail perfect, and they put on a tremendously complex pageant, a parade, a military parade, with wheeling and marching and, you know, the whole, like, real amok, you know, with all precision. During one of the festivities, one of the young Hasidim got carried away, and as he rode past on his horse, he lopped off the head of one of the statues of one of the Christian saints. You see, it was all under the shadow of the monastery and the thing, and like, it looked carried away, and he destroyed the statue. When they heard about it, you know, in those days, the Jews' life wasn't worth anything. Now, that meant a pogrom for sure. Nobody would survive. But the cardinal in charge, of a particular Christian, he sent a message to the Rebbe, and he said to him, I'm prepared to hold back my people, provided that you discipline that man severely enough. And you know what that meant. If you Jews do that, we'll be satisfied. So the Rebbe immediately accepted, and he said, and we want you to be there to see it. We will discipline this man. We will put him through an experience so brutal that you'll be satisfied. So they accepted, and they appointed a day. And sure enough, the cardinal and the bishops and all these Christian clergy and all the things of the church, they put them on a big platform, big days. And now they were going to publicly discipline this hapless chassid, right? How did they do it? They all marched onto the field in their uniforms, the chassidim, right? In their Russian, perfect slow march, you know, somber music, the whole military pageant. And finally, after a lot of complex maneuvers, they formed a gauntlet, you know, two lines, soldiers. And this guilty chassid had to come onto the field, walk down the line in utter humiliation and shame among all his colleagues. And the Rebbe, dressed in a general's uniform, was standing at the head. When the chassid arrived at the general, at the head of the gauntlet, Rebbe faced him, took his sword out of his scabbard, struck it over his knee, threw it on the ground, ripped his rank off his shoulders, cut the buttons of his tunic, and said to him, "Now go." And the cardinal said, "I didn't think that'd be that severe." Because you're dealing with a world where the rules and the etiquette and the form is more important than life itself, you see. That's the concept. Anyway, these are, in Lashon Kodesh, there aren't words. There aren't words for those things, because those aren't things of essence. So another rule is you go back. All right, we've run out of time. Let me just mention very briefly one or two other principles, although each of these needs to be thoroughly felt out and thought through. You go back to the first time the thing appears and work it through from there. You go back to the word the Torah uses. It's another element of essence. Theoretically, you should also be able to define where this thing lies in the cycle of the year. Because in the cycle of any year are the roots of all things in Torah. Okay, that's another way you should be able to do it. There's also another dimension, which is more controversial, I'm not going to go into detail, and that is looking into the deeper wisdom. You see, the idea of the deeper wisdom, the plenius of Torah, is the tools that really, it's the concepts, the abstract concepts that underlie all practical reality. Strictly speaking, you need to go back there. Now, this takes training, and of course, it's especially in the non-Hasidic world, it is more hidden than the non-Sfardi world. It is more traditionally hidden because it has certain dangers, can be misunderstood. It's a delicate area. But strictly speaking, if one wants to understand any Torah concept, you really need to go back to the principles that underlie all of reality. This wisdom of the depth of Torah, call it Pnimius HaTorah, call it Kabbalah, call it whatever you want to call it, this is the field in which all the principles, the abstract principles, the mathematic principles underlying all calculations, if you like, this is the algebra underlying the arithmetic. This is the area in which all principles are contained. Everything that exists in the world is always located in a principle in this wisdom. And therefore, you should be able to demonstrate where anything that arises in Torah is located in this incredibly complex and rich world of spirituality that is taught in abstractions and in very demanding and subtle abstractions. But in that world, anyone who really knows Torah will know how to identify in that field the elements that express themselves, and it's a very inadequately studied field. It's becoming much more popular now. Many of these Sforim are now being published again and printed, and many people are involved in this field, and it has its dangers, of course, but that is in fact where it is. I'll just finish with an anecdote. You know, Rav Moshe Shapira is one of the great thinkers in this generation, in this area, in all areas, of course, but he's most perhaps known here. I never forget the realization after going to Yeshiva for many years. I never forget sitting there once on a Thursday night and suddenly realizing You know, I thought he was talking about an idea or about the parasha. I suddenly realized that every single week he's doing nothing other than following through absolutely thoroughly on all of these themes. He takes something in the parasha, and by the time the shiur was over, you'd seen where it's derived from the first time in Chumash and how it plays itself out, how the word actually says it, which deep principles, although he would only allude to them, are the underlying ones that govern this phenomenon, why it's applicable in this particular parasha, why it is this time of year that he's giving rise to this particular issue. And by the time he was finished, there was just nothing else. There's just nothing else. That everything, all of your experience and all of your wisdom and all of the Torah you knew was saying nothing other than building this particular thing. You know, I have a friend who used to be a pilot in the Israeli Air Force who ended up in Yeshiva. And he became a brilliant Talmid Chacham, very talented fellow. And he told me that he had the following experience. Every Motzei Shabbos, he and six or seven friends used to have a shiur with Rav Moshe in his house. They would sit around the table, gifted young men, Israelis, he would sit around the table and he would give a shiur. What was the shiur on? I asked him. He said, well, each of us would say a different subject that we wanted to know about. That means the first one would say he wants something on the parasha. The second fellow would say, what's the concept of the sukkah shelev yoson? The third would say something else. And Rav Moshe would give a shiur on one subject that was the essence of all of those. Not connect them. I can also do that often. Not connect them. One subject that was the essence. So once when I heard that, I couldn't understand it. So once I had the effrontery to ask Rav Simcha Wasserman, I was very close to Rav Simcha, our families were related. I once had the chutzpah to ask him. I said, you know, Rav Moshe Shapiro gives a shiur on Motzei Shabbos. And they ask him 8 different questions. And he says, I've seen that myself, by the way. He visits us in London occasionally. And we have a chaburi, 20 or 30 people around the table. And he takes questions. And after 6 or 8 questions, he gives a shiur on one thing, which, yeah, if you have to see it to believe it, is the essence of all of those things. And you can't, by the time he's finished, you cannot imagine there's anything else in the world besides that subject. So I said to Simcha, how does he do that? How does he take 8 different completely unrelated subjects and say one? So Simcha looked at me with, do you know Simcha Wasserman? He's looking at those amazing blue eyes. And he said to me, but it's obvious. He said, the Torah is an Eitz Chaim. Not an Eitz Chaim is a tree. You know what a tree is? A tree has twigs which join to form larger branches. The branches form branches, etc. Whenever anyone asks you to connect in Yonim in Torah, he said, take all the issues that he's asking you, simply follow them back far enough till you get to one common trunk and speak about that. What's the problem? What's the problem? Okay. So that is the concept. Okay, we discussed today just a few of the most basic, I actually intended to take an example and work it through, but there wasn't time for that, and I leave you to do that exercise yourself. Yeah.